with the pattern of the walnut's bark. The whistle was shrieking above, then drowned by a tremendous shouting and the sound of shots again in great number. The attackers had reached the meadow. Jamie. The kerchief round his head was sopping. Sweat and gun smoke stung his eyes. He blinked hard to clear them, felt the clash and thud of loading in his bones, the weight of the rifle in his hands butt hard against his sore shoulder. Green. The meadow was surging with men speckled with clots of green uniforms. He fired, and one dropped. Ferguson's whistle screamed, thin and high through the noise. The man was still on his horse, trying to rally his men, though by now it was like rallying fish in a net. They surged to and fro, bayonets still fixed, stabbing air, some firing, but being driven closer in, jostling as they strove to find a target.
Why not?
He coughed again, smoke rasping in his chest, and spat. It was no more than minutes now, and he knew from Randall's book what would happen to Ferguson.
Spare him knowing what's coming to him. Let it be a Scot, at least.
He hadn't time to think more before his sight fixed on the checked shirt and his finger tightened on the trigger. He took a step sideways, barrel following his target, and something snagged round his foot. He kicked at the clinging shrub, impatient, and a thorn pierced his calf.
Ifrin!
He jerked and looked down. The large snake that had bitten him was writhing round his leg in panic, and he flung himself away, kicking out in his own panic. The first bullet struck him in the chest. Chapter 147. A Lot of Blood. It seemed to go on forever, but I knew it was only minutes, would be only minutes more. Shouts from above, yelling, shooting, the crash of fired muskets, and the higher-pitched crack of rifles. I felt each shot as though it had hit me, and shuddered against my tree. I heard it when the tide turned. An instant silence and more shooting and yelling, but it was different now. Less noise. The shots were fewer. The whistle fell silent and the yelling increased, but it had a different tone. Savage, exultant. I couldn't wait any longer. I left the refuge of my tree and scrambled up the mountainside, slipping and falling and scrambling on all fours. I came high enough to be able to see what was going on. Chaos, but the shooting had all but stopped. I made my way up higher, onto the meadow. I was drenched in sweat, my legs shaking from the tension of the last hour, and my heart pounding like a steam hammer.
Where are you? Where are you?
There was a crush of men at one side of the meadow, the loyalist prisoners, half of them in green provincial uniforms, the rest farmers like our own men.
Our own.
I tried to look in all directions at once to see, if not Jamie himself, someone I knew. I saw Cyrus, the tall tree, looking as though he'd been struck by lightning, his face black with powder smoke except where the sweat had made runnels. He was standing up, though, looking about him in a dazed sort of way. People were moving everywhere, jostling, milling. One young man ran into me, knocking me off balance. I caught myself and began to say, "I beg your pardon," by reflex. Then I saw that he had Jamie's rifle. "Where did you get that gun?" I said fiercely, and grabbed him by the arm, squeezing as hard as I could.
"Who the hell are you?"
He was shocked and offended, trying to pull away. I dug my fingers into his armpit and he yelped and jerked, trying to get away.
"Where did you get it?" I screamed.
I was clinging like grim death, and he screamed too, writhing and cursing. He kicked me solidly in the shin, but he loosed his hold on the rifle, and I let go his other arm and snatched it.
"Tell me where you fucking got this, or so help me God, I will beat you to death with it."
His eyes showed white like a panicked horse, and he backed away from me, hands out imprecation.
"He's dead. He don't need it no more."
"Who's dead?"
I hardly heard the words. The blood had surged so hard into my ears that they were ringing. But a big hand clasped me by the shoulder and pulled me away from the boy. He promptly turned to flee, but Bill Amos, for it was he, let go of me, and with two giant strides he had hold of the boy, picked him up with both hands, and shook him like a rag.
"What's going on, missus?"
he asked, setting the boy down and turning to me. The words were calm, but he wasn't. He was trembling all over with a mixture of bloodlust and reaction, and I thought he might just kill the boy inadvertently. His big fist was squeezing the boy's shoulder rhythmically as though he couldn't stop, and the boy was squealing and begging to be let go. I couldn't hold the rifle. It slipped from my grasp and I barely caught it, its butt jolting into the ground. It's Jamie's. I need to know where he is. Amos blew out a long breath and huffed air for a moment, nodding.
"Where's Colonel Fraser?"
he asked the boy, shaking him again but more gently.
"Where's the man you took this in from?"
The boy was crying, head wobbling and tears making tracks through the dirt and powder stains on his face.
"But he's dead,"
he said, and pointed a shaking finger toward a small rocky outcrop near the edge of the saddle, maybe 50 yards away.
"He's bloody not," I said, and slapped him.
I shoved past him, hobbling. His kick had bruised my shin, though I didn't feel pain, leaving Bill Amos to deal with whatever he felt like dealing with. I found Jamie, lying in a patch of dry grass just beyond the outcrop. There was a lot of blood. I fell to my knees and groped frantically through his heavy clothes, wet with sweat and blood. "How much of this blood is yours?" I demanded.
"All of it."
His eyes were closed, his lips barely moving.
"Bloody fucking hell. Where are you hit?" "Everywhere."
I was deeply afraid he was right, but I had to start somewhere. I could see that one leg of his breeks was sodden with blood. No arterial spurting, though, that was good. I started feeling my way down his thigh.
"Dinner. Fash, sass."
He wheezed deeply. With tremendous effort, he opened his eyes and turned his head enough to look up at me.
"I'm no afraid," he whispered. "I'm not."
A bout of coughing seized him. It was nearly silent, but the violence of it shook his whole body. He wasn't coughing up blood.
Why is he coughing?
Pneumothorax. Cardiac asthma. His shirt was sodden. If a ball had touched his heart but not penetrated.
"Well, I'm bloody afraid," I snapped, and tightened my hold on his thigh, digging my fingers into his unresisting flesh. "Do you think I'm just going to sit here and watch you die by inches?"
"Aye."
His eyes closed and the word was no more than a whisper. His lips were white. He sounded completely certain about it, and the fear that was swarming over my skin burrowed suddenly inward and seized my heart with its claws. His blood was spreading slowly, dark and venous. I was kneeling in the blood-soaked mud, and there were huge splotches of it on my apron, black-red. It felt warm on my skin, though that must only be the heat of the day. "You can't," I said helpless. "Jamie, you can't." His eyes opened, and I saw them look past and through me as though fixed on something far, far away.
"Forgive me,"
he said, his voice no more than a thread, and I didn't know whether he spoke to me or to God.
"Oh, Jesus," I said, tasting cold iron on my tongue. "Jamie, please, please don't go."
His eyelids fluttered and closed.
I couldn't speak.
I couldn't move. Grief overwhelmed me, and I curled into a ball, still grasping his arm, holding it with both hands, hard, to keep him from drowning, from going down into the bloody earth, away from me forever. Beneath the grief was fury, and the sort of desperation that lets a woman lift an automobile off her child. And with the thought of a child and the reek of blood, I was, for a split second, not kneeling in Jamie's blood on a blistering plain of surrender,
but on splintered floorboards by a sputtering fire, hearing screams and smelling blood with nothing to hold on to but a wet scrap of life and that one phrase, "Don't let go." I didn't let go. I seized him by the shoulder and managed to roll him onto his back, shoved the soaked coat back and ripped his shirt down the middle. The bullet wound in his chest was evident, slightly left of center, welling blood. Welling, not spurting. And I didn't hear the distinctive sound of a sucking chest wound. Wherever the ball was, it hadn't yet penetrated a lung. I felt as though I were trudging through molasses, moving with unutterable slowness. And yet I was doing a dozen things at once, yanking tight a tourniquet round his thigh. The femoral artery was all right, thank God, because if it wasn't, he'd already be dead. Applying pressure to the chest wound, shouting for help, palpating his body for other injuries, one-handed, shouting for help. "Auntie." Ian was suddenly on his knees beside me. "Izzy, push on this." I grabbed his hand and slapped it on the compress over the chest wound. Jamie grunted in response to the impact, which gave me a small jolt of hope. But the blood was spreading under him. I worked doggedly on. "Listen to me," I said, after what seemed a long time. His face was closed and white, and the rumble of the crowds reached me like distant thunder from a clear blue sky. I felt the sound move through me, and I fixed my mind on the blue. Vast and empty, patient. Peaceful, waiting for him. "Listen," I said, and shook his arm hard. "You think you're going to die by inches, but you're not. You're going to live by inches, with me."
"Auntie, he's dead?"
Ian's voice was low, rough with tears, and his big hand warm on my shoulder.
"Come, stand up now. Let me take him. We'll bring him home."
I wouldn't let go. I couldn't speak any more. I hadn't strength for it. But I wouldn't let go, and I wouldn't move. Ian spoke to me now and then. Other voices came and went. Alarm, concern, anger, helplessness. I didn't listen.
"Blue, it's not empty. It's beautiful."
I'd found four wounds. A ball had gone clean through his thigh muscle, but missed both bone and artery. Good. Another had scored his right side below the rib cage, a deep furrow bleeding profusely, but it hadn't penetrated his abdomen, thank God. Another had struck him in the left kneecap. Fortunate as to minimal bleeding, and as to his walking in future, that could take care of itself. As to the chest wound, it hadn't penetrated his sternum entirely, or he'd be dead, I thought. But it might have gone through and torn his pericardium, or one of the smaller vessels of the heart, its momentum killed by the sternum, but still allowing damage. "Breathe," I said to him, realizing that his chest wasn't rising noticeably anymore. "Breathe." I didn't see any chest movement. But when I held my hand in front of his mouth, I thought I could detect the faint movement of air. I couldn't do chest compressions, not with a cracked sternum and an invisible ball in nor under it. "Breathe," I said, under my breath, as I pressed a fresh dressing onto his knee and wrapped it hastily with a length of bandage to give light pressure. "Please, please, please breathe." Young Ian had materialized again at some point and was squatting beside me, handing me things from my pack as I needed them. He seemed to be saying the Hail Mary, though I couldn't tell whether he was speaking Gaelic or Mohawk. I wondered vaguely how I knew it was the Hail Mary, and realized slowly that I had the vision of a vast blue space in my mind. Blue, like the Virgin's cloak. I blinked away stinging sweat and saw Jamie's face composed and tranquil. Was he seeing heaven? And I seeing it through his closed eyes? "You are losing your mind, Beecham," I muttered,
and kept working, willing the bleeding to stop.
"Feed him honey water," I said to Ian.
"He can't swallow it, Auntie."
"I don't bloody care. Give it to him."
A hand reached over Ian's shoulder and took the canteen.
Roger.
Face and hands blood smeared, and his black hair come loose, hanging wet with sweat, full of red and yellow leaves. I might have sobbed in the minor relief of having him there. He held the canteen to Jamie's mouth with one hand. The other reached out and touched my face gently. Then his hand rested on Jamie's shoulder and shook it less gently.
"You can't die, mate. Presbyterians don't do last rites."
I might have laughed if I'd had any breath to spare. My hands and arms were red to the elbows. I wouldn't let go. I couldn't speak any more. I hadn't strength for it. But I wouldn't let go, and I wouldn't move. Ian spoke to me now and then. Other voices came and went. Alarm, concern, anger, helplessness. Ian and Roger. I didn't listen.
Blue. So beautiful. It's not empty.
My face was pressed against his chest, my mouth on his wounded breastbone, the silver taste of blood and salt of sweat on my tongue. I thought I could feel the slow, so slow, thump of his heart.
Lub, dub. Lub, dub.
I thought of Bree's racing heart, of tiny David's small, busy thump beneath my fingers. Tried to feel my own heart in my fingertips. Force all of that life into his.
Don't let go.
I was vaguely aware from time to time that things were happening around me. People were shouting. A few shots. More shouting. I heard Roger's voice, but couldn't spare enough attention to know what he was saying. I felt it, though, when he knelt by Jamie and laid a hand on him. Something flickered through him and through me, and I breathed it in like oxygen. Jamie's smell had changed, and that frightened me badly. I could smell hot dust and horses and hot metal and gun smoke and the muddy stink from puddles of horse piss, and the panicked, sharp smell of broken plants and the shattered tree trunks on the hillside below. I could smell Jamie's sweat and his blood.
God, the blood!
It had saturated my bodice and stays, and the fabric stuck to me and to him, a thin crust of hot stickiness, not the cut metal smell of fresh blood, but the thick stink of butchery. The sweat was cold on his skin, slick and nearly odourless. No vital reek of manhood in it any more. His skin was cold beneath the film of sweat and blood, and I pressed myself as hard against him as I could, holding tight to the shapes of his back, trying to force myself into the fibres of his muscle, reach the heart inside the bony cage of his chest, make it beat. Suddenly I was aware that there was something warm and round in my mouth. A metal taste, stronger than blood. I coughed, lifted my head enough to spit, and found that it was a musket ball, warm from his body. He was breathing still. Only a faint waft of air on my forehead, perceptible only because it cooled my own sweat. Breathe, I thought fiercely, and pressed my forehead against his chest, against the small dark hole of the wound, seeing the blood-stained pink and the air-starved blue of his lungs beneath. I reached for his heart, but had no words, only the weight of its soft, slowing beat, the motion like two small heavy balls that I held, one in each hand, one heavier than the other, and tossed them to and fro, catching each one separately but close together.
Lub-dub. 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 Shouldn't we take her away?
a rough, uncertain voice somewhere far above me.
I mean, he's... leave her.
Young Ian. He sat down beside me. I heard the scuff of dirt beneath his moccasins and the sigh of stretching buckskin on his thighs. I drew a quick sobbing breath, deep as I could, pulling air for both of us. And young Ian rested a hand on my shoulder, tentative, not sure what he should do. But he was there. There. A solid shape with no form, glowing with a fractured light. Ian was hurt, but not badly. I could feel his strength pulse and fade, pulse and fade. I felt the pulse of it through my flesh. For an instant I was disoriented, couldn't find the limits of my own body. I felt Jamie's slow surrender in my belly and veins, Ian's strong pulse in my heart and arteries. Where am I? I concluded dimly that it didn't matter. Help me, I said silently, and yielded my own boundaries. Chapter 148. Not yet. We stayed there, the four of us, through the rest of that day, the night beyond, and most of the next day. When I finally resumed contact with the world, I was curled beside Jamie, a sheet of canvas flapping in a gentle wind above us.
Here, Auntie.
Young Ian's hands slid under my arms and he lifted me gently into a sitting position.
What?
I croaked, and he put a canteen to my mouth. I drank. It was cider, and I had never tasted anything better. Then I remembered. Jamie? I looked bleary round for him, but couldn't make my eyes focus.
He's alive, Claire.
It was Roger, squatting next to me, smiling. Bloodshot and black stubble, but smiling.
I don't know how you did it, but he is alive. We were afraid to move you, the two of you, I mean, because you wouldn't let go of him.
I looked around. We were still behind the rocky outcrop, shielded from the battlefield, but I could hear and smell the cleaning up. Grunts and talk, and the shoof of shovels and soft thud of dirt cast aside. Burying the dead. But not us. I put a hand on Jamie.
He looked dead. I certainly felt dead.
But apparently we weren't. Jamie's chest moved under my hand. He was breathing, and slight as the movement was, I felt it as though the gentle wind moved through me.
Do you think it's safe to move him, Auntie?
Young Ian asked.
Roger Max found a farmhouse not too far away where you can stay for a bit until you're both strong enough to travel.
I wetted my cracked lips and leaned over Jamie. Can you hear me? I said. His face twitched briefly, fell into stillness, and then, after an agonizingly long moment, his eyes opened. Only a dark blue, red-rimmed slit, but opened.
Aye,
he whispered. The battle's over. You're not dead. He regarded me for a long moment, his mouth slightly open.
Not yet,
he said, in what I thought was a rather grudging tone. We're going home, I said. He breathed for a moment, then said,
good,
and closed his eyes again. Chapter 149. Angry, irascible, difficult sons of bitches. Fraser's Ridge, October the 22nd, 1780.
I'm no dying in my sleep,
Jamie said stubbornly.
I mean, should the Lord choose to take me in my bed, I'll go, of course. But if I'm going to die by your hand, I want to be awake.
My hands were shaking. I folded them under my apron, both to hide the trembling and to control the urge to throttle him. You have to be asleep,
I said, as reasonably as I could manage, which wasn't all that reasonably. Your leg has to be completely immobile, and I can't manage that if you're awake. I don't care how strong you think you are. You can't keep still enough, and even tying you to the table, which I fully intend to do, I glared at him, wouldn't be enough to completely immobilize you. So? My hands had stilled, thank God, and I brought them out from under the apron, picked up the ether mask, and pointed a finger at him. Either you lie flat right now and take it, or I get Roger and Ian to tie you down, and then you take it. But you're getting it, like it or not. He immediately sat up and swung his feet off the table, apparently intending to make a break for it, cracked kneecap or no. No meat. Roger grabbed him by an arm and a shoulder, and Ian, slithering behind the table like a water moccasin, grabbed Jamie's other arm with one hand and forearmed him across the throat. Lie down, uncle, he said soothingly, tightening the chokehold and pulling Jamie back against him. It will be all right. Auntie Claire will not kill you, and if by accident she does, Roger Mack's a proper minister now, and he'll give you a fine funeral. Jamie made a noise somewhere between a gurgle and a growl, his face going a dark, congested red as he struggled. I was actually pleased to see that he had enough blood now to achieve such a colour. Let him go. I waved Roger and Ian off, and they reluctantly released him. He eyed me, his chest heaving, but didn't try to get away as I came closer. I put my hand on his uninjured knee and leaned close to speak quietly to him. If you lie down by yourself, I'll put you out before they tie you, I said, and I'll untie you as soon as I finish the surgery. I won't let you wake up bound, I promise. He was getting enough air now, and his face lost the look of incipient seizure.
You want to promise me I'll wake up?
He spoke gruffly, and not only because of the choking. I can't promise that, I said as steadily as I could. I squeezed his knee. But I'll lay you odds of 100 to 1 that you will. He looked at me searchingly for a long moment, then sighed.
I will. I've been a gambler since I was wee. I suppose this is no time to quit.
Leaning back on his palms, he brought his legs back up on the table. The effort to move the wounded one made sweat spring out on his forehead, but he kept his lips tight pressed together and made no sound when Roger and Ian took his shoulders and eased him down. A boiled napkin lay on the counter behind me, displaying 4 narrow strips of hammered gold. Bree had made them and had painstakingly bored the tiny holes I would use to screw them to the bone. The tiny screws, courtesy of Jenny's watch, offered immediately when I asked. This was going to be a tricky, painstaking bit of surgery, but I was smiling behind my mask as I soaked and shaved, then swabbed the skin of his knee with alcohol. The situation reminded me strongly of the day I had prepared to amputate his snake-bitten leg. This leg. I could still see the narrow groove the bite had left, just above his ankle, nearly hidden by the furs of red-blonde hair. Today I wasn't afraid for his life, and I rejoiced in the knowledge that what I was going to do to his knee wouldn't hurt him while I was doing it. I glanced up the table at him. He met my eye and scowled at me. I wiggled my eyebrows at him and scowled too, mocking him. He snorted and lay back, but his face relaxed. That was what I was happiest about. He'd fought me, and even though he'd been forced to give in, he wasn't giving up his right to be cranky about it. Over the years, I'd seen a lot of sweet, amiable, biddable patients who succumbed within hours to their ailments. The angry, irascible, difficult sons of bitches of either sex almost always survived. The cotton gauze of the mask had grown damp in my hand, and I wiped my hand on my apron. I nodded toward the ether bottle on the counter, and Bree handed it to me, troubled eyes fixed on her father, who had folded his hands across his belly and was staring doggedly at the ceiling, looking disturbingly like a medieval knight in the crypt of some cathedral. All you need is a sword clasped to your chest, and a little dog under your feet, she told him, and maybe a suit of chain mail. He snorted slightly, but his face relaxed just a hair.
Breathe slow and deep, I said, in a low, soothing voice. The scent of ether had risen like a ghost when I uncut the bottle, and I saw Ian hold his breath as it reached him. Jamie's eyes met mine, and his muscles tensed as I fitted the mask over his nose and mouth. Just breathe. You'll feel dizzy for a moment, but only a moment. The clear drops fell one by one onto the gauze and disappeared. Breathe in. Count for him, Bree. Backward, from 10. She looked startled, but obligingly began. 10, 9, 8, 7. His eyelids fluttered and then popped open as he felt it. Breathe, I said firmly. 6, 5.
He's gone, Roger said quietly, then realized what he'd said. I mean, he's asleep.
3, 2, 1. I handed Roger the bottle. Make sure he stays that way, I said. One drop every 30 seconds. I went to wash my hands in alcohol one final time and checked over the instruments and supplies I'd laid ready while Ian and Bree tied him firmly to the table with rags and linen bandages. His fingers had relaxed and his hands hung limp when they laid his arms at his sides. The light was good, the fine hairs on his arms and legs glowed gold, and the seeping blood in his bandage was the colour in the heart of a rose. My own breath had calmed, and my heart beat slowly. I could feel it in my fingertips. Some saint was with me now. I wanted to smooth the soft hair back from his brow, but didn't want to break what semblance of sterility I had, so left it. Jamie was tied down as securely as a barrel of tobacco in a ship's hold, but Brianna took hold of his leg and steadied it, just to be sure. I nodded at her, turned to my work, and spread the skin over Jamie's kneecap as taut as I could. I picked up a pledget, and the sharp sting of alcohol joined the musky ether, drowning the smell of pines and chestnut mast from the window. "Smells like a proper hospital, doesn't it?" I said, and tied my own mask tight over my face. I saw Jamie safely awake, his knee bandaged and splinted, and a solid dose of laudanum administered for pain. Leaving him asleep in the surgery for now, I wandered down the hall toward the kitchen, feeling somewhat sharp-set, though with a deep feeling of satisfaction. The surgery had gone beautifully. He had good, dense bones that would knit well, and while recovery would undoubtedly be painful, I was sure that he would walk easily again, in time. The house was quiet. My assistants had all scattered. Fanny was walking out somewhere with Cyrus, and the rest of them had all gone up to the Murray's cabin to drink apple cider and milk the goats. I was therefore somewhat surprised to see Jenny in the kitchen, sitting alone on the settle, gazing contemplatively at the big cauldron, steaming gently on the fire. "Your brother's doing well," I said casually, and opened the pie safe to see what was available. "Good," she said absently, but then sharpened into attention. "I mean, aye, that's very good. Will he walk easy, do you think?" "Not for some weeks, probably," I said, "but he'll certainly walk, and it will get easier the more he does it." I found 3/4 of a dried peach pie and brought it back to the table. "Will you have a bit of this with me?" "No," she said automatically, but then noticed what it was. "Och, I will, thanks." I sliced the pie, fetched milk from the cooling cistern Bree had built in the corner of the kitchen floor, and set out the food. She rose slowly and came to sit opposite me. "The Sachem came to my house this morning to say it's time for him to be away back north," she said. "Oh?" I took a forkful of the pie. Delicious. Probably Fanny had made it. She was the best of the family bakers. Jenny said nothing, and while she had a fork in her hand, she hadn't yet stuck it into the pie. "And?" I said. No answer. I took another bite and waited. "Well," she said at last, "he kissed me." I raised an eyebrow at her. "Did you kiss him back?" "Aye, I did," she said, sounding astonished. She sat for a moment, contemplating, then looked at me sideways. I didn't mean to, she said, and I smiled.
Did you like it?
Well, I'll no lie to you, Claire.
I did.
She let her head fall back and stared at the ceiling.
Now what?
You're asking me?
No, I'm asking me, she said, adding a small Scottish snort for emphasis.
He's going north, back to his nephew, to tell him what all he's learned about the war, so he can decide whether to stick with the British or... Her voice trailed off. He'll need to go before the weather turns.
Did he ask you to go with him? I asked gently.
She shook her head. He didn't need to ask, and I didn't need to answer. He wants me, and I... Well, if it was only him and me, that would be one thing, but it's not. And so it's the other thing. I can't go and leave my family here, especially when I ken all the things that might happen to all of you. And then there's Ian. The softness in her voice told me that it was Ian Moore she meant, her husband, rather than her son.
I ken he wouldna mind, she said, and no just because the Sachem told me so, she added, giving me a direct blue look. But he sees Ian with me, and I didn't need to hear it.
I know he's with me. He always will be, she said more softly.
One day, it may be different. Not that Ian will leave me, but it may be different.
I said so, and the Sachem says he'll come back.
When the war is over?
When the war is over. I felt a huge lump in my throat. I'd heard that before, long ago, caught in the jaws of another war, spoken in that same tone of longing, of anticipation, of resignation. Knowledge that if the war should ever end, it never truly would end. Things would be different.
I'm sure he will, I said.
Chapter 150. And what of Lazarus? Fraser's Ridge, February the 11th, 1781. I felt Jamie wake beside me. He stretched, then made a horrible noise and froze. I yawned and rose up on one elbow. I don't know why it should be the case, I remarked, but with injuries of the knee and foot, lying down actually makes them hurt more badly than standing up.
It hurts when I stand up, too, he assured me,
but he shrugged off my offer of a helping hand and gingerly swung his bad leg off the edge of the bed with no more than a hiss of pain and a muffled,
Mother of God!
He used the chamber pot and sat, gathering his strength, before he pushed himself up with a hand on the bedside table and stood swaying like a flower in the breeze. I hopped out of bed, fetched his stick from the corner where he'd thrown it last night, and put it into his hand, wondering just what life had been like for Mary and Martha after their brother Lazarus came back from the dead. Then, watching Jamie struggle into his clothes, I wondered what it had been like for Lazarus. Whatever his state of mind when he died, the poor man would presumably have left his body with the notion that he was finished with the world. Being unceremoniously reinserted into said body was one thing. Returning to a life that you never expected to lead again was something else. Jamie cast a bleak glance at himself in the looking-glass, rubbed a hand over his stubble, muttered something in Gaelic, rubbed the same hand through his hair, shook his head, and made his way downstairs for breakfast, his passage marked by the thump of his stick on every other step. Beginning to dress myself, I thought that in fact such a thing happened to a hell of a lot of people who perhaps hadn't come as close to physical death as Jamie had, but had still lost the life they were accustomed to. I realized, with a small shock, that I'd had exactly that experience myself, and more than once. When I'd come through the stones the first time, yanked away from Frank and a new life that we'd just begun after the war, and then again, when I'd had to leave Jamie before Culloden. I hadn't revisited those memories in a long time. I didn't want them back now either, but it was actually a small comfort to remember that they'd happened, and that I'd survived being uprooted, losing everything I'd known and loved, and yet
I'd bloomed anew. That was a comfort, and I comforted myself further by considering Jenny, who'd lost the greater part of her life when Ian had died, and then courageously turned her back on what was left of it to come to America with Jamie. The provincial prisoners from the battle had been disarmed, rounded up, and marched away. I didn't know where. But the militias had all disbanded, essentially, as soon as the shooting stopped, men making their way home in small groups, looking for the pieces of their lives that they'd lost along the way. How long would it be, I wondered, before we might be compelled to do it again? It was 1781. In October, the Battle of Yorktown would be fought and won. The war would be over as wars ever are. There would be more fighting between now and then, much of it in the south, but not near us. Or so Frank's book said. He'll be all right then, I said to my reflection in the looking-glass. Jamie had healed well, physically. His knee would improve with use, and he was back in the house he loved. Most of his militia had survived the battle, with mostly minor injuries, though we had lost two men. Tom McHugh's second eldest son, Greg, and Valarcair Finney, a single man in his 50s from Ullapool, who'd lived on the ridge less than a year. If Jamie was inclined to sit in his study and stare pensively into the fire, or to set out for the still and turn back, he hadn't yet gone all the way there, and I didn't know whether he couldn't bear to see it deserted and in disrepair, or couldn't yet face the job of getting it back into production. I had faith that he would come all the way back. Little Davy had been a great help. The tiny boy had brightened everyone's heart, and Jamie loved to sit with him and say things in Gaelic to him that made Fanny laugh when she heard them. Still, there was something missing in him. I glanced back at the unmade bed. He hadn't felt up to making love for more than 2 months after we'd come home. Little wonder. And while I had been able to rouse him physically as he healed, there was something missing. Patience, Beecham, I said to the mirror, and picked up my hairbrush. He'll mend. I normally brushed my hair by feel, but was still looking into the glass as I raised the brush, and stopped. Well, bloody hell, I said. My hair was white. Jamie had told me my hair was the colour of moonlight once, but then it was no more than streaks of white around my face. It was not entirely white now. The mass of curls that foamed around my shoulders was still a mix of brown and blonde and silver, but the newer growth above my ears was a pure and simple white that shimmered in the morning sun. I set down the brush and looked at my hand, turning it back and forth. It looked quite as usual, thin and long-fingered, with strongly marked tendons and blue veins visible. I remembered Naya Wene then, and what she'd said to me. When your hair is white, that is when you will find full power. I hadn't thought of it in some time and felt a tingle down my spine now. The memory of holding Jamie's soul on that mountaintop, calling him back to his body. Roger had said to me quietly, when no one was nearby to hear, that he thought he had seen a faint blue light come and go in my hands as I touched Jamie, flickering like swamp fire. Jesus H. Roosevelt Christ, I said very quietly. In the afternoon, I went up to my garden. The air was still chilly, but patches of bare earth were beginning to show through the melting snow, and it was time to prepare trenches for the early peas and bean vines. Jamie came with me, saying he could do with air, and we walked slowly, to accommodate his knee, up the slope. The two lieutenants, Gilbert and Oliver, had dug good trenches for me the year before all hell broke loose, and I said a brief prayer for them, and for Agnes. Which one did she marry, I wondered, and for Elspeth and Charles Cunningham. Were they all back in England now? For sweet peas and pole beans and edible peas, these all carefully saved from last year's harvestings. Jamie obligingly dumped the manure into one trench and set about the job of shoveling earth in and mixing it well with the manure, merely hissing through his teeth when his bad knee twinged. This trench ran behind the beehives. There were 11 hives now. One swarm had divided before King's Mountain, and I'd been in time to catch a departing new queen and install her in a new hive with her followers. And young Ian had found a wild swarm and gone with Rachel and Jenny to capture them and bring them back. All of them had survived the winter, and a few bees would now and then come out and cruise slowly round the garden before going back in. Jamie looked cautiously behind him to make sure he wouldn't knock against the hives with his spade, then glanced at me in surprise.
"I hear them," he said. "Or at least I think I do."
He advanced cautiously, putting his ear close to the woven straw of the skep. "Yes, you do," I said, amused at his expression. "Honeybees don't die in the winter, and they don't really hibernate either, so long as they have enough honey stored up to last them till spring. They cluster together and shiver to generate warmth, but otherwise they just eat and sleep, I suppose."
"I can think of worse ways to pass the winter," he said, and smiled. "Holding your feet."
The interesting question as to just what parts of him I would like to hold while sleeping was obliged to wait, as we heard the rustlings and shuffle of heavy footsteps coming up the path. I wasn't surprised to see John Quincy Myers. He routinely stopped at Fraser's Ridge when he came back from the Cherokee villages where he usually spent the winter. But I was very pleased. "How are you?" I asked, standing back to look up at him after greetings and embraces had been exchanged. He had apparently left his pack at the house and looked much as usual, but thin from the winter, like everyone else.
"Sprightly, missus, sprightly,"
he said, giving me a wide smile that had one or two fewer teeth than it had when last seen.
"And I see your bees are thriving too."
"Yes, they seem to be. And thank you again for giving them to me. We were just talking about what bees do in the winter. Eat and sleep, I imagine."
"Oh, I'm sure they do that,"
he said, and reached delicately to put his hand on one of the hives. He smiled, feeling the faint hum on his skin.
"But I think they pass the time much as we do in the cold, telling each other stories through the long nights."
Jamie laughed at that, but came cautiously closer, putting his hand on one of the hives as well.
"What sort of stories do you think bees tell, Harwich?" "Tales of bears and flowers, I reckon, though a queen maybe dreams of other things."
"If you mean laying thousands of eggs, that sounds more like a nightmare," I said. John Quincy laughed, but tilted his head to and fro in equivocation.
"It's not for a man to say, but I think she maybe dreams of flying free and high with 100 drones in a cloud of mad desire."
"Oh," he stopped, feeling in his pouch.
"I most forgot, missus. I've summat here for you."
He drew out a small package wrapped in a piece of grimy pink calico. "Who's it from?" I asked, taking it. It was light, no more than a few ounces, and something crackled faintly inside.
"That I don't rightly know, Mrs. Clare," he said. "'Twas given me by a woman keeps a tavern down near Charlotte in January. She said it was a black man left it, saying it was for the conjurer woman that lived at Fraser's Ridge, and would she kindly pass it on when someone was to be heading up this way. I do suppose he meant you," he added with a smile. "Ain't that many conjure women in this neck of the woods?"
Puzzled, I opened the little parcel to find a sheet of thick paper carefully folded around a hard object. I unfolded it, and a rock the size of a hen's egg and roughly the same shape fell out into my hand. It was a mottled grey in colour, with white and green splotches. It was smooth and felt remarkably warm, considering the chilliness of the air. I handed it to Jamie and unfolded the large sheet of paper it had been wrapped in. The note was written with quill and ink, the writing a little straggly, but quite legible.
"I have left the army and returned to my home. My grandmother sends this for you in thanks. It is a blue stone from an old place, and she says it will heal sickness of spirit and of body."
I read this astonished, and was about to tell Jamie that it must be from Corporal, evidently now ex-Corporal, Scipio Jackson, when he suddenly reached over and took the paper out of my hand.
Holy Mother.
John Quincy craned his neck to see, interested.
"You be damned," he said.
"That there's your name, ain't it, Jamie?" It was substantially battered. It was torn at one corner, rubbed and dirty. Some of the ink had evidently got wet and run, and the red wax seal had fallen off, leaving a round red stain behind. But there was no doubt at all what it was. It was a copy, the original copy, signed by Governor William Tryon of the grant of 10,000 acres of land in the Royal Colony of North Carolina to one James Fraser, in recognition of his services to the Crown, and sewn to it with thick black pack thread was the letter from Lord George Germain. Chapter 151. A Message in a Bottle. Aboard the Palace. John Gray was allowed to exercise on deck twice a day, for as long as he liked, while they were at anchor. He was accompanied throughout by a powerfully built monoglot sailor, whose sole apparent purpose was to keep him from leaping overboard and swimming for it, and whose one language was neither English, French, German, Latin, Hebrew, nor Greek. He thought it might conceivably be Polish, but if it was, the knowledge wouldn't help him. The rest of the time he was not only confined to his cabin, but attached to it by means of a shackle round his ankle, this equipped with a long chain, this in turn attached to a ring set into the bulkhead. He felt like a limpet. Reasonably adequate meals were provided, as was a chamber pot, and a small pile of books, including several treatises on the evils of slavery. If these were intended to reconcile him to his presumably eventual fate, they had missed their mark by several miles, and he had pushed them out of the small port before settling down with a translation of Don Quixote. He'd been held captive before, but not often, thank God, and never for very long, though the night he'd spent at 16, tied to a tree on a dark Scottish mountain with a broken arm, had seemed endless. I think of that now. He'd largely forgotten it in the confusion of circumstances that had attended his acquaintance with a man he'd thought he'd never see again, and good riddance. But Jamie Fraser was not a man to be easily forgotten, damn him. He wondered briefly what Jamie would think of his present circumstance, or worse, of the circumstances of his eventual death, but pushed that out of his mind as pointless. He didn't bloody mean to die, so why waste time envisioning it? The one thing he was reasonably certain of, regarding Richardson and that gentleman's singular motives, was that he, Gray, wouldn't be killed until Richardson managed to locate Hal, as his life had value to Richardson only as a lever to affect Hal's actions. As to those... He scratched absently at his jaw. Richardson didn't trust him with a razor. His beard was growing out and itched considerably. Hal had, now and then, made intemperate remarks about the conduct of the war, and had, more than once, threatened to go to England and denounce Lord North to his face about the waste of lives and money.
"There are things that need to be said, by God, and I'm one of the few who can say them," was the last such remark Gray had heard from his brother. When was it? 6 weeks at least? Perhaps longer. But John was morally sure that Hal had gone north to find Ben, a conviction supported by the fact that Richardson had so far apparently failed to find him in any of the southern ports. He knew as much from the comings and goings of Richardson's shore agents. His cabin was directly below the big stern cabin, and while he couldn't make out many words, the tone of frustration, with the occasional stamp of a boot overhead, couldn't be mistaken. How long might it take Hal to find Ben, he wondered, and what the devil would happen when he did? Knowing Hal, the only circumstance in which he would not find his errant son was if the damned boy actually was dead now,
whether in battle or from illness. He remembered William's description of Dr. Hunter's vaccinating the populace of New Jersey for smallpox. The wind had changed. It blew into the tiny room, lifted his hair, and prickled his skin. He closed his eyes instinctively and turned his face toward the port. Then he realized that it wasn't the wind that had shifted. The boat had moved. He glanced up, then went to the door of his cabin, where a small latticed opening at the top provided occasional light from the hatchways. He pressed his ear against the opening and strained his ears. No, there was no sound of order and rapid feet, and the rumble and snap of unfurling sails. Thank God they weren't about to up anchor and leave.
I suppose it's just caught a hatful of wind, as my old grandmother used to say about a stiff breeze, he muttered, trying to ignore the spasm of alarm that had clenched his belly for a moment when he thought the ship might be about to sail.
Richardson had moved the ship several times, though not far. Gray had recognized the harbor at Charlestown, but there were two other smaller ports that he didn't know. Now they were back in Savannah. He could see the stumpy steeple of the small church near his house. He tried not talking to himself, fearful that he might go mad, but he found that the effort not to was making him clench his jaws, so he allowed himself the odd remark. He also talked to the might-be pole, which amounted to the same thing, but was less socially reprehensible. Still, he found himself staring absently out of the port for increasing lengths of time, eyes following small boats, flights of pelicans, or now and then a fleeting sight of porpoises, sometimes one or two, sometimes dozens, who proceeded in a remarkably graceful fashion, leaping rather than swimming, but so smoothly that they still seemed part of the water. He was engaged in this sort of mindless abstraction when he heard a key turned in the lock behind him, and whirled round to see fucking Percy Wainwright, who, to add insult to injury, stood staring at him for a moment, open-mouthed, and then dissolved in laughter.
What? John snapped,
and Percy stopped laughing, though his mouth still twitched. He hadn't seen Percy in weeks. Evidently Percy had served his purpose and was allowed ashore.
I'm sorry, John, he said. I didn't expect, He giggled. You look like Father Christmas. I mean, a very young Father Christmas, but...
God damn your eyes, Perseverance,
John said crossly. He touched his beard, self-conscious.
Is it really white?
Percy nodded and edged closer.
Well, not entirely white. It's just that your hair is so fair anyway that it, blends in, rather.
John made a gesture of irritation and sat down.
What are you doing here, anyway? I take it you haven't come to liberate me.
Someone had accompanied Percy. He'd heard the key click in the lock again when the door closed behind his visitor.
No, said Percy, suddenly sobered. No. I would if I could, John. Please believe me. If it helps you to sleep at night, I believe you,
John said, with as much vitriol as he could put into the words, and had the bleak satisfaction of seeing Percy's face fall. John sighed.
What the devil do you want, Perseverance?
Well. Percy steeled himself enough to look up and meet John's eyes directly.
I wanted to say two things to you. First, that I'm sorry. Truly sorry.
John stared at him for a moment, then nodded.
All right. I believe that too, for what it's worth.
Which is not all that much, as I'll likely be dead soon, but still.
And the second? But I love you.
The words came softly, seeming to be addressed to the tabletop rather than John, but he heard them and was both shocked and annoyed to feel a small lump in his throat. He looked down too, not answering. The sounds of the river and the marsh and the distant sea washed through the tiny room, and he could feel the blood pulsing in his fingertips where they rested on the rough wood.
I'm alive. I don't know how to be anything else.
He cleared his throat.
Why do you suppose pelicans don't call out? He said. Gulls scream and cackle like witches all the time.
but I never hear the pelicans make any sort of noise. I don't know.
Percy's voice was stronger now, though he also had to stop to clear his throat.
That's all I wanted. All I needed to say to you, John. Have you anything to say to me?
God, where would I start?
But he didn't say it unkindly.
No. No, wait. There's one thing.
The notion had just come to him, and he doubted that it would be of any help. Percy was a coward and always would be.
But maybe...
He straightened up and leaned toward Percy, the chain rattling on the floor.
Richardson doesn't allow me paper or ink, probably thinking I'll try to toss a message to some passing boat below. I can't write to anyone. Last words, I mean, or farewell, or what have you. I gather you have some freedom, though.
He'd seen from his port Percy being rowed ashore now and then, presumably doing errands for Richardson.
If you can, will you at least go to my house? It's number 12 Oglethorpe Street. I know where it is.
Percy was pale, but his face had settled on its bones.
Of course you do. Well, if you meant what you just said, then, for the sake of any love you've ever had for me, go and tell my son that I love him.
He badly wanted to shout, "For God's sake, tell Willie what's happened. Tell him to go to Prevost and get help." But Percy was terrified of Richardson
and everything else in the world,
he thought with an exhausted pity. And to ask him to risk something like that was likely to make him run away, get drunk, or cut his own throat.
"Please," he added gently.
It was a long moment, and he imagined he heard the wing beats of the pelicans passing soberly over the river below. But Percy nodded at last and stood up.
"Goodbye, John," he whispered.
"Goodbye, Perseverance."
Chapter 152. Titus Andronicus. William came back to the house after yet another unfruitful search of the docks and the taverns on the roads leading out of Savannah, to find Amaranthus pacing to and fro in the front garden.
"There you are," she said, in a tone mingling accusation and relief. "A man's come. I saw him at Mrs. Fleury's tea, but I don't know his name. He says he's a friend of Lord John's, and he knows you. I've put him in the parlour."
He found the man who'd been introduced to him at Mrs. Fleury's as the Cavalier Saint-Honoré in the parlour. He'd picked up one of Lord John's treasured Meissen plates from the sideboard and was running a finger gently round the gilt edging. Yes, it was the same man, a Frenchman. He'd seen him briefly at Madame Prévost's luncheon, too.
"Your servant, sir.
Puis-je vous aider?"
William asked, in as neutral a voice as he could manage. The man turned round, and his face changed as he saw William, going from exhaustion and strain to something like relief.
"Lord Ellesmere," he said, in a thoroughly English accent.
William was too tired and in much too bad a temper to make either inquiries or explanations.
"Yes," he said brusquely. "What do you want?"
The fellow was much less soigné than when last seen. Minus his wig, his hair was short and curly, frosted with grey and matted with sweat, and his linen was soiled, his expensive suit crumpled.
"My name is Percy Wainwright," the fellow said, as though not quite sure that it was. I still am, come to think. I'm Lord John's stepbrother."
"What?"
By reflex, William grabbed the Meissen plate before the fellow could drop it and set it back on the sideboard.
"What the devil do you mean, stepbrother? I've never heard of a stepbrother."
"I don't suppose you would have."
A faint grimace that might have started as a smile faded, leaving Wainwright's face pale and exhausted.
"The family, no doubt, did their best to expunge me from memory after, well, that's of no account. There was a rupture and a parting of ways, but I still consider John my brother."
He swallowed, swaying a little, and William thought the man was unwell.
"Sit down," he said, grabbing one of the small armchairs and turning it round.
and tell me what's going on. Do you know where Lord John is?
Wainwright shook his head.
No, I mean, yes, but he's not. Filius Canis, William muttered. He glanced round and saw Amaranthus lurking curiously just outside the door and jerked his chin at her as though she were a maid. Get us some brandy, please.
He didn't wait for it to arrive, but sat down opposite Wainwright. His stomach had curled up into a ball, tight with apprehension and excitement.
Where did you last see him? He asked, hoping to restore Wainwright to coherence by means of simple, logical questions.
Rather to his surprise, it worked.
Aboard a ship, Wainwright said, and straightened up a little. An Indiaman called the Pallas. A Greek name, I mean, a god of some kind.
The god of battle, Amaranthus said, coming in with a glass of brandy on a tray. She eyed Wainwright narrowly, then glanced at William, lifting a brow. Should she stay or go? He gestured briefly to another chair and turned back to Wainwright.
A ship? All right, where is this ship?
I don't know. They move it. They were lifting anchor as I left. I didn't abandon him, he cried, seeing William's frown.
I would never have left him. But I could do him no good, and I thought, well, he told me, in fact. He told me to go and to find you.
Amaranthus made a small hum, expressing doubt. William shared it.
But no choice but to go on and hope the man could be encouraged to make more sense. Of course, he said, trying to be soothing. And what did he tell you to say when you did find me?
He didn't say exactly, I mean. There wasn't time for a message. They were getting ready. More brandy? Amaranthus asked, getting her feet under her.
Not yet.
William raised a hand, and she sat down, her eyes fixed warily on Wainwright, who was looking more wretched by the moment. All three of them were silent, while Lord John's clock ticked peacefully on the mantelpiece, the cloisonné butterfly within its dome slowly raising and lowering its blue and gold wings. At last Wainwright looked up from his tight-folded hands.
It's my fault, he said. His voice trembled. I didn't know, I swear it, but...
He licked his lips and squared his shoulders.
Lord John has been kidnapped and is in the hands of a madman. He is in great danger, and yes, please, more brandy.
In a moment, Amaranthus said, sitting forward on the edge of her seat. Tell us who this madman is, if you please. Wainwright looked at her and blinked.
Oh. His name is Richardson, Ezekiel Richardson.
Jesus fucking Christ!
William was on his feet and had jerked Wainwright out of his chair by his shirt front in an instant.
What the devil does he want with my father? Tell me, goddammit!
Oh, said Amaranthus, rising. So he really is a madman. Maybe you best put Mr. Wainwright down, William. He can't talk like that. William reluctantly did so. The blood was pounding through his temples, and he felt as though his head would explode any minute. He let go of Wainwright and stepped back, breathing as evenly as he could.
Tell me, he said again.
Wainwright was trembling all over now and sweating heavily, but he nodded, jerky as a puppet, and began to talk. It took several minutes to get it all out, but Wainwright gradually calmed as he spoke, and at last fell silent, staring at the green-figured carpet under his feet. William and Amaranthus exchanged glances over his bowed head.
So, this gentleman... Well, this person, Amaranthus said, mouth pursed as though to spit, wants the Duke not to go to England and tell Lord North things about the war, and so he's kidnapped Lord John and is threatening to kill him unless your uncle acquiesces?
She sounded incredulous, William thought. Richardson's letter had been hard to believe, but to hear the facts like this... Wainwright was nodding.
That's it, he said dully. He has his own reasons for wanting the war to continue, and he thinks Pardlow might be able to convince the Prime Minister otherwise.
Well, he wouldn't be the only one with an interest in the war continuing, William said, beginning to get hold of himself. War is an expensive business, and that means the men who supply it are making a lot of money. I can think of two or three who might want to stop the Duke from spreading notions to the contrary round England, but Richardson?
He eyed Wainwright narrowly, but the man gave no sign of deliberate deception, or of anything, really, save profound distress.
I told you, I know this Richardson, William said abruptly, turning to Amaranthus. And God help me, I think he likely is mad. Some of the things he's done.
He shook his head.
Wait here, he said to Wainwright, and put out a hand to Amaranthus. Come with me for a moment.
The house was quiet. Moira had gone to market, and Miss Crabbe was lying down. Even Trevor was asleep, thank God. Still, William guided Amaranthus out into the garden just in case. Sight of the little grape bower made him think vaguely that neither of them had mentioned his proposal since their return, but the thought vanished like smoke.
What do you think? He asked, glancing back over his shoulder at the house.
I think there must be more truth to the letter this Richardson sent than we even thought. Mr. Wainwright seems more or less sane, but I don't know about Captain Richardson. Is that his rank, Captain?
Well, it was when he was on our side, William said with a shrug. He's turned his coat now, and I think the Americans may have given him a major's commission or even a colonelcy of some kind. They poach officers from European armies with rank because they haven't got any money. The Americans, I mean.
So this Richardson is a turncoat and a madman. The Americans seem not to be very choosy, do they?
I gather they made James Fraser a general, if that tells you anything.
Her eyebrows shot up in surprise.
I do hope he isn't mad, she said, and looked at William speculatively. I don't believe that treason shows up in the blood necessarily, but I'm reasonably sure madness is inheritable. Look at the king, I mean.
No, William said. Mr. Fraser may be a good many things, but he's not mad. And I agree with you about Mr. Wainwright. He may be telling the truth about being Papa's stepbrother. My grandmother, Benedicta, married a widower, and he may well have had a son. But his being Papa's stepbrother is just an explanation for his concern, isn't it?
You mean he might have another reason for coming to find you?
Amaranthus leaned to the side, looking round William toward the house.
Maybe.
William dismissed this with a wave of the hand. But the basic facts are, according to him and the letter now, these. 1. Papa is actually in the hands of Richardson, who is bloody dangerous. 2. Richardson apparently is holding him hostage in order to compel Uncle Hal to do, or rather, not do something. And 3. No matter whether it's possible for anyone whatever to compel Uncle Hal to do anything whatever, he bloody isn't here to do it anyway.
Well, but that's good, isn't it? Amaranthus objected. Presumably, if the only reason this Richardson is keeping your father is to make the Duke do what he wants, then Lord John is safe, as long as the Duke can't be found. Isn't he?
Mm-hmm, William said, in dubious agreement. I don't know. Wainwright says my father's in danger, and he must have reason for thinking that. Regardless, I have to find him, and as quickly as possible. If Richardson is truly mad, then he's unpredictable. He might take a sudden whim and toss Papa overboard in the middle of the sea, or sail away to the West Indies.
The thought struck him like an ice pick in the heart. In the shock of Wainwright's appearance, he'd momentarily forgotten the most important thing the man had said.
He said they were preparing to move it just as he left.
He seized her arm so suddenly that she yelped.
I have to go to the docks. If they haven't sailed.
But they have. He said they were lifting the anchor. They'll be gone by now.
Come on. I need to find out where that ship is or was.
He let go of her arm and, turning, ran toward the house, Amaranthus hard on his heels. William hit the corridor at a dead run, scaring Moira, who was coming down it with her huge shopping basket overflowing with fish and loaves of bread. She leapt out of the way but lost her grip on the basket. William heard feminine cries behind him but didn't stop. The door to the parlour was standing ajar, and he was vaguely conscious of a smell as he shoved it open. Brandy. And vomit. The source of both was Percy Wainwright, who was lying on the floor, curled up like a hedgehog, his back heaving as he retched. He'd thrown up profusely already, but the smell was overlain by the stronger reek of spilled brandy.
"Jesus,"
William said, swallowed, and knelt to grab Wainwright by the shoulder.
"Moira,"
he shouted, seeing the man's face. "Amaranthus, get a doctor. Bring some water and salt, quick." Wainwright was conscious, but his face was clenched like a baby's fist, all lumps and lines. His lips were blue, actually blue. William hadn't seen that before, but he knew it wasn't good.
"What happened?"
he asked urgently, trying to unfold Wainwright and get him into a more comfortable position.
"What's the matter with you?"
Wainwright heard him. He brought one trembling hand to his chest, pressed hard in the middle.
I can't."
William had seen Mother Claire's take someone's pulse more than once, and he hastily pressed his fingers at the side of Wainwright's neck. He didn't feel anything. Moved his fingers, nothing. There. He'd felt a single throb, and then another. One more, then a light, rapid tapping. But this was nothing like the way a heart should beat.
"Here's water, and the salt cellar,"
Amarantha spoke behind him, breathless.
"Moira's gone for Dr. Erasmus. What's wrong with him?"
"Oh, God. He must have drunk the brandy."
The pulse, if that's what it was getting slower, and Wainwright's body twisted, mouth gaping open, looking for air.
"His heart, I think, maybe. Here, give me it."
He took the carafe from her hand and sloshed some over Wainwright's face, making him open his eyes, then poured a little into his open mouth. It ran out at the side, and so did the next try.
"Salt?"
Amarantha said, very doubtfully.
"You give it to soldiers with heat stroke,"
William said, and having no other possibility to hand, grabbed the salt cellar and spooned salt onto the back of Wainwright's tongue, trying to wash it down with water. That worked, to the point that it did make Wainwright come to himself sufficiently as to swallow, but within a few moments a new spasm seized him, and he belched everything up in a spew of salt, water, and blood. Not a lot of blood, but the sight alarmed William beyond anything he'd seen so far.
"Brandy,"
he said urgently, and sat back on his heels. It was the most popular remedy for almost anything, maybe. He spotted the bottle on the floor and grabbed it, hearing Amaranthus's cry even as his fingers touched the round, black, glassy curve.
"Not that one,"
she said, and bent to snatch it from his hand. It slipped and rolled across the rug, spilling the last of its aromatic reddish drops, and displaying its label.
"Blut der Märtyrer."
Wainwright made a soft, gurgling noise that faded into a sigh, echoed by the faint sputter of his loosened bowels. There was a deep silence in the room, but beyond it, William heard the faint cries of distant gulls.
"Jesus," he said softly. "The ship will have sailed by now."
Chapter 153. Special Delivery. I was in the garden sowing turnips and talking to the bees, who were beginning to float through the air in ones and twos, following the elusive scents of early dogwood and redbud, when I heard the faint rumble of a wagon coming up the road to the dooryard. Then I heard an unmistakable yodeling hail borne on the breeze. "That's John Quincy," I said to the bees, and laying down my trowel, I hurried to the house, rubbing dirt from my hands with my apron. It was indeed John Quincy, beaming with delight.
"Brung you all a special delivery, missus," he said,
and pulled the canvas off the load in his wagon, revealing the excited faces of Germain, Joni, and Félicité, where they had been hiding, packed in amongst his boxes and barrels like heads of cabbage.
Grand-mère, granny, grandma.
The children leapt out of the wagon and rushed to me, all talking at once. I was hugging everyone, overwhelmed by the gangly, long-legged bodies of the girls and the sweetly grubby scent of unwashed children. Germain stood back, smiling shyly, but then Jamie came round the corner of the house and shouted, "Germain!" And Germain broke into a run and leapt into his grandfather's arms, nearly knocking him flat. Jamie grunted from the impact, laughed and kissed him, then looked up at John Quincy, the question clear in his eyes.
"Where are the rest of them? What's happened?" "Fergus and Marsali send you their kind love," John Quincy assured him, interpreting his look, "and they're all well. They thought as how it might be healthier for the little uns to have some mountain air, though, so when I passed through Wilmington they asked would I bring 'em on. Fine company they've been, too."
"Healthier?"
Jamie repeated, eyes still fixed on John Quincy, who nodded. Germain's arms were still locked around Jamie's waist, his face buried in Jamie's shirt. He patted the boy's back.
"Aye, I expect so. Come along in and hae a bite and a whet. There's fresh buttermilk, and the girls have made beer."
Germain had changed. Children do, of course, and with astonishing rapidity. But he had taken that abrupt step across the chasm into puberty while he was away, and seeing the new addition was something of a shock. It wasn't only that he was taller, though he was by a good 4 inches. It was that the bones of his face now framed a man's eyes, and those eyes kept careful watch on his sisters and on any threat to them. We'd made a fuss of everyone and brought them and John Quincy in to eat. The girls kissed me, then flung themselves on Jamie with cries of joy, questioning and exclaiming in horror at the bandage round his knee and the raw scar on his arm, the healed and half-healed ones on his chest.
"Grandpère will be fine," I said firmly, luring them away with molasses cookies. "All he needs is rest."
I flicked my eyebrows upwards, indicating that he might decamp to the bedroom, but he smiled and shook his head.
"I'll do an Ian. And surely you dinna think I'd leave whilst you have a bowlful of sweeties in your hand?"
Fanny poured milk for everyone, smiling, with a special smile for Germain, who went pink in the face and buried his nose in his cup, and I passed out cookies.
"We thank you kindly, missus,"
John Quincy said, and nibbled his cookie like a mouse, his teeth not allowing for more robust eating.
"Germain, did you give your grandpa and granny what you bought for 'em?"
"Oh."
Germain clapped a hand to the small leather bag he carried, with a strap across his chest. He gave Jamie a slightly guilty look, but reached into the bag and handed a letter to me as I was closest. It was written on good rag paper and sealed with green wax.
"For you and grandpère,"
he said, frowning, as his voice soared and broke in the middle of the last word.
"Grandpère,"
he repeated, in a voice as deep as he could make it. I kept my face as grave as possible and broke the seal.
"Milord, milady, there was an event last month here in Wilmington that disturbed us greatly. I will not describe this because while I trust all my children entirely, it is not at all uncommon for the seals of letters to be broken by accident. Leave it that 2 men were killed, and in a way that caused us great uneasiness. It is somewhat ironic that we left Richmond feeling it unsafe and returned to the familiar ground of North Carolina. I wish Marsali and the children all to return to you, and if things become worse, she promises that she and the twins will go to the Ridge. But for now, she says that she will not leave me, and I cannot leave undone the work of freedom to which I am called. You put the sword into my hand, milord, and I will not lay it down. Votre fils et votre fille, Fergus Claudel Fraser, Marsali Jane McKimmy Fraser.
Oh, I said softly. Germain's lips were pressed tight, and his eyes were shiny.
Germain, I said, and kissed his forehead. We're so glad to see you. And what a wonderful job you've done seeing your sisters safely all this way.
Mm-hmm, he said, but looked somewhat happier.
2 days later, we were up in our bedroom in mid-afternoon, me attempting to read Manon Lescaut in French, while preventing Jamie from executing a quiet sneak to avoid what he referred to as the third level of purgatory.
Have any of the bairns told you what Fergus's unpleasant event was, Sassenach?
Jamie paused in the midst of a set of the exercises I had set for him, and I frowned at him. You're just trying to get out of the lunges, I said. I know it hurts. Do it anyway, if you ever expect to walk without a stick again. He gave me a long, level look, then shook his head.
When pain and anguish wring the brow, a ministering angel thou, he muttered.
I laughed. Oh, woman, in our hours of ease, I quoted back. Uncertain, coy, and hard to please. Where the devil did you get that one?
Roger Mac,
he said, gingerly bending his bad knee while easing his weight onto it.
Efreen!
Someone, or several someones, shoot you full of holes and fracture your sternum and you don't make a peep, I observed. Ask you to stretch a few muscles.
I was busy dying,
he said, through gritted teeth.
And if you think it's simple to talk with a fractured sternum, oh, God!
Just three more, I coaxed. If you promise to do your arm rotations and push-ups next. I'll go and talk to Fanny. Germain's spent a lot of time with her since he came back. If he's told anyone, it will be her. He made a noise that I took for agreement, and I sponged his face with a damp towel and went to find Fanny. She was luckily in the root cellar and alone.
Oh, she said when I explained my curiosity. Yes. Yeah, he did. I asked him, she added honestly. He said he didn't mind telling me, but he didn't want his little sisters or the other girls to find out. I'm sure he didn't mean you, though, she assured me.
War was everywhere, and so it was no surprise to hear that Fergus's new print shop in Wilmington had suffered the same sort of petty vandalism and anonymous threats shoved under the door as had happened in Charlestown. Nothing worse had happened, though, and the town as a whole was fairly quiet. The family took good care to bolt their doors at night and latch their shutters, but they felt safe in the daytime.
Germain and Mr. Fergus were working the press, he said, and his ma'am and the girls had gone out. Two men came in and Germain went to the counter to see what they wanted.
One man had said he wanted to see the proprietor well enough, but the other had a short fowling piece under his coat, and Germain saw it. He didn't know what to do, but stuttered out that he'd fetch his father. He'd turned to go back to the press when the first man quickly opened the hatch in the counter and pushed Germain to the floor. Both men ran through toward the back room where Fergus was working, but Germain managed to cling to the leg of the second man and shriek at the top of his lungs.
He said he was looking straight up into the barrel of the gun, Fanny said, her eyes wide with the telling. He thought he'd be killed any moment, and I suppose he might have been saved. Mr. Fergus shot out of the back room with a ladle full of hot lead from the forge and flung it at the first man.
Not unreasonably, the man had bellowed in pain and panic, turned and tried to run, blind, had tripped over Germain, still on the floor, and crashed into the second man who was trying to raise his gun.
Mr. Fergus grabbed hold of the gun with his one hand, Germain said, and they fought over it, and the other man was crawling about the floor screaming. Then the gun went off and blew a hole in the ceiling, and there was plaster and pieces of wood everywhere. Germain was too scared to move, but his father had a big pistol in a holster and got it out and shot the man right in the head.
Fanny swallowed, looking a little ill.
And then he told Germain to go into the back room, and he did.
but he looked out and saw his father kneel down and shoot the other man in the head too. He said Mr. Fergus's gun was a special two-barreled cannon, she added, obviously impressed by this detail, because he only has one hand.
Oh, dear Lord. I felt almost as shocked as though I'd seen it myself. The print shop splattered with blood and broken plaster, Fergus white-faced and shaking with reaction, and Germain frozen with shock.
Germain and his papa had to haul the bodies out the back door into the alley before his mama and the girls came back. He said his little brothers were screeching in their cradle, but they couldn't stop to do anything about it.
They had put the bodies under some rubbish and then swept the shop and cleaned things as well as they could, and when Germain's mama came home with the girls, his papa told Germain to take the girls to the ordinary and bring back food for supper. Mr. Fergus must have told Germain's mama what happened, because she was gone when he came back, and then she came in a little while later and said something quiet to Mr. Fergus, and Germain heard a wagon in the alley that night. And when he peeked out in the morning, the men were gone.
Germain thinks it was the Wilmington Sons of Liberty who came and took the men away, Fanny said seriously. His papa knows all of them.
I would suppose so, I murmured, feeling somewhat thankful that at least Fergus and Massali weren't completely without support and protection. That knowledge did nothing for the ball of ice that had formed in my chest.
I cannot leave undone the work of freedom to which I am called.
Oh, Massali, I said under my breath. Oh, dear.
I woke to the whisper of falling snow and the strange grey snow light seeping through the shutters. Peeping out, I saw the world of the forest, dark conifers and the sprouts of spring plants alike, robed in a pure and delicate white. It was a spring snow and would be gone in hours, but for the moment it was beautiful, and I put my hand against the cold window pane and breathed its freshness, wanting to be part of it. Jamie was still asleep, and I made no move to wake him. Roger would tend the livestock this morning, assisted by the younger children. I tiptoed out of the room and made my way down to the kitchen, where Sylvia and Fanny were sitting at the table, nibbling toast, before beginning to make breakfast. Bree was dozing in the corner of the settle, Davy at her breast, making smacking noises as he nursed. I yawned, blinked, and nodded, but didn't join them. I'd made beef tea the day before, and thought that perhaps a nice hot cuppa would hearten Jamie on his rising. He'd had a bad night, one of those nights that everyone over the age of 40 has now and then, when the body is beset by cramping muscles, aching joints, and sudden jactitations that jerk you from the edge of sleep as though you've been tossed off a gallows. And in his case, doubtless the sudden searing of his mostly healed wounds as he twitched and turned. He was awake when I came upstairs, sitting on the edge of the bed in his shirt, rumpled, stubbled, and apparently still half asleep. His shoulders slumped, hands hanging between his thighs. I set down the two cups I brought and ran a hand gently over his tousled hair. How do you feel this morning? I said. He groaned and opened his eyes a little more.
Like someone stepped on my cock.
Really? Who? I asked lightly. He closed his eyes again.
I did again, but it feels like it was someone heavy.
I put a hand to his forehead. He was warm, but warm from bed, not feverish. I fetched a cup of beef tea and put it into his hand. He breathed in the steam, then took a sip, but set it aside and stretched himself slowly, groaning. I eyed him for a moment, then knelt down on the floor in front of him and took hold of the hem of his shirt. Let me see about that, I said. His eyes opened all the way and fixed on me.
You do ken what a metaphor is, Sassenach,
he began, making an abortive effort to catch my hands, but my touch, very warm from the teacups, made him exhale and lean back a little.
Hmm.
I rubbed a little with both hands, slowly,
I think your circulation is in order. Any bruising?
Well, not yet, he said,
sounding mildly apprehensive.
Fafnir, would you...
I pushed the shirt back and bent down, and he stopped speaking abruptly. I reached farther under, making him spread his thighs by reflex, and saw the small curly hairs rise.
Would you let go my balls, Sassanach?
He said, stirring restively.
It's not that I didn't trust you, but...
I'm checking for any sign of an incipient hernia, I told him, and ran two fingers well up, probing gently into the deep heat of the flesh between his legs. His thighs were lean and chilly, but...
Ooh, I've got an incipience, he said, squirming a little. But I'm sure it's no hernia. Now what the devil are you doing?
I'd let go. Turning, I reached over to the small bedside table where I'd left a scatter of things. Things turned out of my apron pockets at night and not always retrieved in the mornings. The bluestone Corporal Jackson had sent me was there, and I picked it out of the litter, rubbing it between my hands to warm it. There was a little bottle of sweet oil on the table, too, and I dribbled a bit onto the stone. Jamie was watching this process, still apprehensive.
If you mean to stick that up my arse, Sassanach, he said, I'd be very much obliged if you didn't.
You might enjoy it, I suggested, and took hold of him with one hand, applying the warm oiled stone in a therapeutic manner with the other.
Aye, that's what I'm afraid of.
But he'd relaxed a little, leaning back on his hands, and then relaxed a little more, sighing, his eyes closing again. I went on with a slow massage, but reached out with my other hand and picked up one of the cups, taking a mouthful of the still-hot beef tea. It tasted wonderful, soothing and delicious. I swallowed, set down the cup, and put my mouth on him. His eyes flew open and his hands clenched on the bedclothes. I said. He said something in Gaelic under his breath, but it wasn't a word I knew. I laughed, but silently, and knew he felt the vibration. His hand was resting on my back, large and warm. Something had happened between us on the battlefield, and while most of it had gone, I could still feel the echoes of his body in a deeper way than I had before. I felt the blood rise in him, pulsing, warming his skin, and the air he breathed deep and pure in my own lungs. Suddenly, his hands were under my arms and he lifted me, urgent.
Inside you,
he said, his voice husky.
I want to be inside you.
I scrambled up in a flurry of skirts and he lay back on the bed. A brief scuffle, and then that sudden, solid, gliding joining that was never a shock. And always a shock. Both of us sighed and settled into each other. I lay on him moments later, feeling his heart beat under me, slow and strong. I breathed in and smelt the deep, bitter tang of him. You smell wonderful, I said. I felt drowsy and deeply happy.
What?
He lifted his head and turned it, sniffing down the collar of his shirt.
Jesus, I stink like a dead boar.
You do, I said. Thank God. Chapter 154. Never fear to negotiate. Never negotiate from fear. I was smashing lumps of asafoetida resin with a hammer when Jamie stuck his head into my surgery.
Jesus, Sassanach!
He pinched his nose between two fingers.
What the devil is that? And why are you pounding it with a hammer?
Asafoetida, I said, letting out the breath I'd been holding and taking a step backward. First, you extract the resin from the roots of the ferula plant, which is relatively simple. But the resin is very hard and you can't grate it. So you have to smash the lumps with a hammer, or stones, if you haven't a hammer. It occurred to me that the hammer I had was, in fact, his, and I reversed it in my hand,
offering it to him hilt first, like a surrendered sword. "Do you want it back?" He took the hammer, inspected it at arm's length for damage, then shook his head and handed it back.
"That's all right. Wash it before you bring it back to me, eh? Is that the stuff they call devil's dung?"
"Well, yes. But I'm told that the people where it grows use it as a spice. In food, I mean." He looked as though he wanted to spit, but refrained.
"Who told you that?"
"John Gray." "It probably tastes better when cooked," I said hurriedly. "Did you come in here for something, or were you just looking for your hammer?"
"Oh, aye. I was sent to ask, will you come be a witness?"
"To what?" I was already rubbing charcoal dust over my hands to kill the stink.
"I'm no altogether sure. Right now it's a Weestermash, but it might be a wedding, if they'll quit crying themselves down to each other."
I didn't waste time asking for details, but quickly rinsed away the charcoal and dried my hands on my apron as I followed him down the hall to the parlour. Rachel, Ian, Jenny, and Sylvia Hardman were there, along with Prudence, Patience, and Chastity, and so were Bobby Higgins and his sons, Aidan, Ori, and Rob. The Hardmans and the Higginses were drawn up like opposing armies, Sylvia and her daughters on the settee, with Bobby facing them from the depths of Jamie's big chair, Aidan standing by his side, and Ori and Rob sitting, in so far as one can use such a word when describing young males under the age of 6, on the carpet at his feet. Rachel, Jenny, and Ian stood at the end of the settee. Everyone turned to look when we came in, and I sensed at once a tumultuous atmosphere in the room. It wasn't as though they were quarrelling, but clearly there was some tension. Jamie touched the small of my back and guided me to Bobby's side of the room, where he himself took up a station behind the big chair.
"We're settled," he announced. "What was it you were seeing as I left, friend Sylvia?"
She gave him a narrow look and drew herself up with dignity. "I said to friend Higgins," she said evenly, "that he should know that I have the name of a whore."
"So I was told," Bobby said diplomatically, not saying who told him.
He looked at her and touched the faded but still stark white brand on his cheek.
"I'm a convicted murderer. I think maybe you should be more bothered than me."
A pink tinge crept into Sylvia's cheeks, but she didn't look away. "I didn't need telling," she said, "but I thank thee for thy consideration. Whilst as a friend I must naturally deplore violence, I understand that thy circumstances were such as to cause thee to believe that thee did no more than thy duty." Bobby looked down briefly, but his eyes came back to hers.
"That's true," he said quietly,
and leaning forward, he reached out to cup his hand lightly round Chastity's soft cheek.
"I reckon you were doing yours."
Her mouth opened, but no words came out, and I saw that her eyes were bright with unshed tears. She managed a jerky little nod, and Patience and Prudence emitted little hums of approval, though they sat bolt upright, hands neatly folded in their laps.
"I'm a soldier no more," Bobby said. "I'll willingly swear, if swearing doesn't displease you. I mean, not to take up arms again, save to hunt for food. And I reckon you don't mean to return to your former circumstances?"
Sylvia glanced at Jamie, her long upper lip drawn down over the lower one.
"No, she doesn't," Jamie said firmly. "Never."
Bobby nodded.
"So," Bobby said, sitting back and looking at her very straight, "will thee marry me, friend?"
She swallowed, eyes very bright, and leaned forward, but Aidan forestalled her reply.
"Please do marry him, Mrs. Hardman," he said urgently. "He can't cook anything but porridge and beans with burnt bacon." "And thee thinks I can," she said, the corner of her mouth twitching.
"She's not a good cook either," said Prudence, as one required to be truthful, "but she can bake bread. And we know how to make stew out of turnips and potatoes and beans and onions and a pork bone, Patience put in. We wouldn't let thee starve.
Sylvia, quite pink in the face by this time, cleared her throat in a monitory sort of way.
If thee can shoot an animal for the pot, friend Higgins, I believe I can butcher and roast it, she said. You can always cut off the burnt bits.
Grand, said Aidan, delighted.
So it's a bargain, is it?
Well, it might be if you'd stop talking, Bobby said, giving Aidan a look of mild exasperation.
Daddy,
said Chastity brightly, holding out her arms to Bobby.
Sylvia went bright red and everyone laughed. She put a hand over Chastity's mouth.
I will, she said.
Chapter 155 Quaker Wedding Redux. Jamie remembered the first Quaker wedding he'd attended vividly. It had been in Philadelphia, in a Methodist church, and the congregation had consisted largely of friends, the sort who were for liberty, plus a couple of English soldiers in full-dress uniform, though Lord John and the Duke of Pardlow had tactfully left their swords at home. The service had been unique, and he thought the same was likely to be the case today. The most striking thing about this one was the number of children present. There were two benches at the head of the meeting house, with the entire Higgins family seated on one, and all of the Hardmans on the other. Bree and Roger sat down front, Brianna with wee Davy in her arms. Fanny, Jem, Amanda, Totis, Jemma, Joni, and Félicité, so aptly called Fizzy, were squirming on the bench in front of Claire and himself, presumably on the theory that a soft but menacing clearing of the throat on his part would ensure restraint on theirs. He hummed a bit, low in his chest to make sure his voice was in good order, and saw Jem and Germain stiffen slightly. Good. His breastbone still hurt when he took a deep breath, but he could take a deep breath, and he thanked God for that. He'd walked all the way to church, slowly, and his left knee hurt like the devil, but his heart was light. He was alive, he could walk. Claire was beside him, and death was once more a matter that he needn't fash himself about. Bobby Higgins abruptly stood up, and the congregation hushed instantly.
I thank you all for coming here today, he said,
but it came out squeaky, and he cleared his throat audibly and repeated it, nodding to the congregation. His face was flushed. He was very shy and no orator, but he stood steady and held out his hand to Sylvia, who was pale but poised. She stood, took his hand, and turned to the congregation herself.
As Robert says, we thank thee for coming, she said simply.
I've not done this before, Bobby said to her. You'll maybe need to guide me.
It's not difficult, Patience Hardman said encouragingly. No, Prudence agreed. All he has to say is that thee marries her.
Well, but he has to say he'll feed her, well, us, doesn't he?
Prudence put in.
And protect us.
He might say that, Patience agreed dubiously, but he doesn't have to.
I marry thee is enough, isn't it, Mummy?
Sylvia had her eyes squinched shut and was rapidly turning as red as her husband-to-be.
Girls, she murmured, please.
The ripple of amusement among the congregation died away. Bobby and Sylvia looked at each other. Away, faces flaming, then back. Aidan McCullum stood up from the bench and walked up beside his stepfather. Aidan was 13 and nearly as tall as Bobby.
That's all right, da, he said,
and turning round he beckoned to his younger brothers who scrambled up beside him. He beckoned to the Hardman girls, who looked at one another in question, then came to a silent agreement and stood up too.
We're going to marry you, Aidan said firmly to the girls.
All of us are marrying all of you.
Will you... Oh, sorry. Will thee all marry us all?
We will,
Patience and Prudence said together, beaming. Patience bent down and murmured to Chastity,
who turned her cherubic beaming face on Rob, said loudly,
"I marry thee."
And toddling over, clutched him round the middle.
"Kiss me,"
she added, and standing on tiptoe, planted a loud "mwah" on his cheek. It was some time before order was restored. Jamie's half-healed sternum hurt amazingly, and he was not the only member of the congregation who had laughed themselves to tears. He found that he couldn't stop, though. Claire handed him a clean handkerchief, and he buried his face in it, remembered grief and present joy and fear and peace, all spilling out like cold, pure water. Everyone came down the hill to the new house, where we'd unpacked the baskets the women had brought and laid out the rudiments of the wedding feast before leaving for the meeting house. Now the kitchen was organized, mostly chaos as we rushed to slice fruit and meat and pie and bread, to shake the butter from its molds and ladle bowls of jelly and ketchups and sauces and drizzle honey over the roasted yams and chestnuts. Jamie, Roger and young Ian had brought down 3 barrels of the 2-year-old whiskey, and Lizzie and Rachel had made enough beer to drown an army of thirsty moose. I hoped it would be enough. I caught a glimpse of Mandy by the window, her curls tied up with a blue silk bow, earnestly poking bits of food into Chastity's mouth, like a mother robin feeding her brood, though Chastity was quite old enough to eat with a spoon by herself. I smiled and looked round for the other girls, only to find them under my nose, earnestly shoveling succotash into several large wooden bowls, chattering like magpies.
"You're so lucky,"
Fanny was saying, envy in her voice.
3 brothers. I've never had so much as one."
Prudence and Patience were quite beside themselves, pink with excitement under their new starched caps, and both laughed at this.
"We will share the with thee, Frances,"
Patience assured her,
"especially Rob." "And we will be thy sisters,"
Prudence added kindly.
"Thee shall not lack for family."
I saw Fanny's face change, and she looked down to hide it, realizing only then that she had accidentally dropped a spoonful of butter beans and corn onto the table instead of into the bowl.
"God damn it,"
she said. Prudence and Patience gasped, and I stepped forward, meaning to make intervention, but Patience blinked suddenly, catching sight of something, and I turned to see what she was looking at. The Crombies had not come to the wedding, feeling that people marrying each other without benefit of clergy was, if not ungodly, at least slightly immoral. Roger had pointed out to them that a Quaker ceremony was essentially the same as handfasting, which, as Highlanders, they abided. To which Hiram had riposted that handfasting was necessary when there was no minister to be had in order to prevent outright sin and illegitimate children. But, as the Ridge had a minister at present, how was it that Mr. Mackenzie was not personally offended at this refusal of his services? Rachel had sent Ian up to tell the Crombies that they were more than welcome to come to the wedding feast afterward, even if they didn't feel they could sanction the meeting at which the marriage occurred. But I doubted that any of them would. And most of them hadn't. Cyrus, however, was now hovering in the kitchen door, his eyes fixed resolutely on Fanny, despite the rich blush on his cheeks. He was dressed in his best Sunday clothes, with what had to be Hiram's ancient but well-tended dark blue plaid over his shoulder, and his hair braided formally over each ear. I took the spoon from Fanny's hand and nodded toward Cyrus, who had a small package wrapped in a linen napkin in one hand. "Why don't you take Cyrus to give his congratulations to the happy couple?" Fanny was as scarlet as Cyrus by this time, but she tidied her cap, brushed down the front of her good white dress with the blue and yellow embroidery, and went to meet him with every evidence of self-possession.
"Oh," said Patience with respect, "is he Fanny's suitor?" "Does friend Jamie approve of this?"
Prudence asked, frowning at them.
"Fanny's too young for such things, is she not?"
"She's got her courses," Patience said with a shrug.
"She told me." But he's so tall. How could...
It's a little early to be calling Cyrus anything like that, I think, I said firmly. They're friends, that's all. Here, give me a hand with these trays of fried fish. They're to go down to the big table under the spruce tree. I helped them out to the porch, then stood for a bit, looking over the festivities. Sylvia and Bobby sat in chairs beside each other under the big white oak, and I saw Fanny leading Cyrus down through the multitudes to talk to them. It was too early for people to be drunk, but a number of them would be in another hour or two. People were eating at trestle tables and on the grass, on the porch and the steps, and the delectable smells of roast pork and cinnamon cake laced with whiskey fumes perfumed the air. My stomach rumbled suddenly, and Jamie, who had come out of the house behind me, laughed.
Have you no eaten anything at all yet, Sassenach?
Well, no, I was busy.
Well, now you're not,
he said firmly, and handed me the plate of buttered corn, fresh roast pork, and yams with chestnuts he was holding.
Sit down and eat an Ian. You run off your feet.
Well, but there's still... I swallowed a mouthful of saliva. Well, maybe. He took my elbow and led me to my rocking chair, this temporarily empty. I sat, suddenly grateful for the throb of relief that shot up from my ankles to the back of my neck. Jamie put the plate on my lap and thrust a fork into my hand.
You're no going anywhere, Sassenach, until you've eaten that, so dinna be telling me otherwise. Jem, bring your granny some nut bread and some of the peach cobbler, wi' a good bit of cream on it.
Well, if you insist. I smiled up at him, forked up a bite of honeyed yams, and closed my eyes, giving myself up to ecstasy. I opened them, hearing a slight change in the rumble and chatter of the crowd. Had the rest of the Crombies come after all? But no, it was a rider on a grey horse, a single tall man in a tricorne and a dark greatcoat that flapped like wings as he rode, coming up the wagon road and doing so at the gallop. If that's effing Benjamin Cleveland, I began, getting my feet under me. Jamie stopped me with a hand on my shoulder.
No, it's not.
Something in his voice brought me slowly to my feet. I set my plate down beneath the rocking chair and moved next to Jamie. He was steady enough, but his right hand was folded hard round the head of his stick, the knuckles white. People were turning to look at the rider, distracted from their conversations. Jamie stood stock still, his face unreadable. Then the rider came right to the edge of the porch and reined up, and my heart leapt as I saw who it was. William snatched off his hat and bowed from the saddle. He was breathing hard, his dark hair was pasted to his head with sweat, and there were hectic patches of red across his broad cheekbones. He gulped air, his eyes fixed on Jamie.
Sir, he said, and swallowed. I need your help.
The End. This is Davina Porter. We hope you have enjoyed this production of Go Tell the Bees That I Am Gone by Diana Gabaldon. Recorded books are available wherever audiobooks are sold. Thank you for listening to Recorded Books.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.